The Record Podcast is supported by Sound Solutions, providing counseling and therapeutic services to help with life's challenges such as depression, anxiety, addiction, and more, with personalized care that helps patients restore balance to their lives. With 7 locations serving King County, more at soundsolutions.health. Sound Solutions. Care today.
Welcome to The Record. Welcome to Monday. I'm Bill Radke. Texas writer Ben Fountain was a novelist when the British newspaper The Guardian told him, "We love the way you write novels. Will you cover America's 2016 presidential election for us?" Fountain's new book is Beautiful Country, Burn Again, and you will meet him in about 20 minutes or so on this program. Before that, though, we're going to begin our show by continuing to help you fill out those empty bubbles on your fall election ballot. On The Record, we are debating all 4 of the state initiatives on your ballot, and today's question is, should local governments be prohibited from taxing groceries? Now, there's much more to say about that. Before our debate, let's check in with KUOW reporter Ruby DeLuna, who's been following this issue. Hello, Ruby.
Hi, Bill.
What would this measure do if passed?
Well, if passed, as it's written, this would, it means cities, counties cannot pass taxes on certain grocery items. And this would include raw or processed foods, beverages or anything for human consumption. And that would include milk and produce and grains.
And why is this on the ballot?
Well, this was launched after Seattle passed its own soda tax last year.
And on the sweetened beverages.
On the sweetened beverage, yes. So starting this year in January, the city started collecting taxes on sugary beverages, which is close to about 2 cents per fluid ounce. And so the soda that you buy, the Snapple, the Red Bull that you would buy at a store, it gets taxed.
And not taxed, not a sales tax when you buy, but that it's been taxed on the distributor.
On the distributor, exactly.
Yeah. So as you say, Ruby, Seattle has implemented this. We're talking about a statewide initiative. Seattle has implemented this sweetened beverage tax. And what do we know about how that's gone here in Seattle?
Well, so far, money has been first of all, when the city council voted on this, passed this, it said that the revenue would go toward healthy food programs, community scholarships, things that would help the communities that are greatly affected by this. And I was listening on the city council meeting today. They were meeting on the budget, and the original estimate for this revenue was about $14 million, and they had to revise the estimate to now close to $21 million.
Okay. And finally, before we get into our yes-no debate, what groups are making up the yes and no campaigns on this state initiative?
Well, if you look at the local groups who support this campaign, these are small business owners. There's a minority, a coalition of minority businesses, the Washington Food Industry Association. But then if you look at the funding behind this campaign, it's mainly a lot of these beverage corporations that you might have heard of, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Dr. Pepper Snapper Group, and Red Bull. So those are the supporters of this initiative. On the no side, you're looking at public health advocates, people who work on obesity issues, and groups like the American Heart Association, the Washington Healthy Kids Coalition, and the El Centro de la Raza.
Okay, Ruby DeLuna giving you the brief on this state initiative, and we'll come back and talk a little more after we get into some pros and cons, Ruby, so thank you. Again, this is Initiative 1634 on your November ballot. It would prohibit local governments from imposing taxes on retail food and beverage distributors. And here to talk pros and cons from the yes on Initiative 1634 side, we have Pete Lamb, a senior business agent with Teamsters Local 174. Hi, Pete. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
And from the no on Initiative 1634 campaign, Jim Krieger, executive director of Healthy Food America. Thanks for coming back, Jim.
Good to be here with you, Bill.
I'll start with the advocate. Pete, why should listeners pass 1634?
So the reason why your listeners should pass I-1634, Yes to Affordable Groceries, is we believe very strongly for 2 reasons. One, we believe that this is about jobs. protecting good family wage jobs throughout the state of Washington.
How would it protect jobs?
Because these type of taxes have been shown to decrease jobs. We've seen that in Philadelphia with our Teamster brothers in Philadelphia, and we're concerned about that here.
So less stuff is sold, so that hurts the Teamsters who deliver it to stores,
correct,
et cetera?
Okay. Yeah, and if you look at it, our members, just giving an example of our members are involved in production of food items, whether it's the Dairy Gold plant in Rainier Ave or from food production to the shipping of it, the warehousing of it, to putting it on the shelves. Our members are part of that whole process.
And that's because more tax means people buy less of it.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So that you said that jobs was your first
jobs
point, and you said you had another
one. And the other piece is in regards to affordability and fundamental fairness. And we know that these type of taxes impact those that can least afford to pay it. People on fixed incomes, working families, and also, you know what, people of color. And that's why you have over 1,400 coalition members of this campaign. Most of the business partners on that are actually businesses of color, because they're the ones that take it on the chin more than anyone. And also you have a number of different labor organizations, whether it is the Teamsters all across the state of Washington, the machinists, also the building trades, Martin Luther King County Labor Council,
okay,
as part of this. And so it's a broad-based coalition.
Okay. And before, one more question before I get to Jim is, listeners will want to know what taxes we're talking about that are affecting things in this way. Are you just talking about the Seattle sweet and beverage tax, or are you talking about what other taxes are you on groceries
so,
are you talking
so we're
about?
Talking about, to be very specific, we're talking about what they call privilege taxes, the privilege of being able to do business in so-and-so city, right? And so this would stop the ability for local governments to put privilege taxes on distributors related to food, grocery items. And that is the deal. Can still do it at the state level. We believe that it's more appropriate to do it at the state level. But that's what this voting yes on 1634 does.
And are those taxes happening now? Or you said stop the ability to put on the
so, taxes? Yeah. So we have one example here in the city of Seattle. We do know that the other side is very, very adept in regards to identifying cities in regards to go after these type of taxes.
Okay.
So.
All right. Good. So, Jim, what's your rebuttal here? Why should our listeners vote no on Initiative 1634?
I think there are three fundamental reasons to vote no on 1634. First of all, this is pure and simple Big Soda's attempt. We saw, as Ruby said, this is totally funded by Big Soda, Pepsi, Coke, and so on, to take away local control.
Not totally, but the vast majority.
99.9%. Funded by Big Soda to take away local control from our communities to decide what's best for them. So prevent local communities from across Washington State from deciding if they want to pass a tax on sugary drinks and if they have needs in their communities they want to raise money for those revenues to support. If you look at the editorial opinions across now, most of the major newspapers in the state have called this out specifically. The Tri-City Herald, for this is us, it's not a debate about whether or not soda should be taxed. It's about whether citizens should relinquish local control. The second reason is that it's deceptive and misleading. This is not about taxing groceries. This is about protecting the profits of Big Soda. No one is proposing taxing meat, dairy, or any other product. Even though the Yes on campaign are putting out flyers, I got one in my mail saying cost of food go higher for the meat tax. They cited an article from Atlantic and Newsweek. I read the article. What the article basically said is any such approach would be extremely unlikely in the United States. And there is no proposal in Washington State to tax these products. So it's deceptive. It's been called one of the most misleading ad campaigns in the history of Washington politics by Danny Wiesnett of the Seattle Times. So that's what it's about. I think what it's also about is it's not about fairness and affordability. This initiative in Seattle is raising money to make food more affordable for low-income people and people of color by the Fresh Bucks program and providing access. It's making childcare and early learning opportunities more affordable. So it is about helping low-income people when the soda taxes are passed. And so it also addresses something that's profoundly unfair and inequitable, which is diabetes, obesity, and heart disease disproportionately affect low-income communities and communities of color. And that's why the revenues from these taxes taxes are going into those very same communities to help prevent those conditions.
So I want to help listeners understand this best we can. Pete, you're saying these are taxes that there's a tax on sweetened beverages that's already been levied in Seattle, and you're concerned about taxes that could be levied on distributors elsewhere. And Jim is saying that's deceptive because there are no taxes on groceries, non-sweetened beverage groceries anywhere in the state. So I'll start with you, Pete. How is this not a deceptive ad to have talk about meat taxes and have people with the arms full of, you know, milk and bread?
It's not deceptive based on the fact that there is the ability to do it. And we actually didn't think there was the ability to do it. So when we actually regrouped and talked about this whole issue, we found that the, you know, privileged taxes, you do have the ability to tax groceries. You do have the ability to tax food. And I want to tackle this whole issue in regards to misleading, because, you know, this entire campaign last year, we talk about it's only about sugar-sweetened beverages, that the Seattle tax is only about sugar-sweetened beverages. That is false. It is not true. There are items that aren't sugar-sweetened beverages that are taxed.
And like, then
there,
like what?
For example, there's issues, drinks like some juice waters that don't meet the threshold of 100% fruit juice, which is under the law. Those are taxed. I've got examples here that are taxed, right? But they're not sweetened. They're basically what my mom used to do when we didn't have a whole lot of money. So she'd take a can of frozen concentrate. She'd break it into quarters, and she would put 20 in water, and be just horrible tasting stuff. But now,
but it's got too much. It's got enough sugar content that it's
not
taxed.
It's not technically 100% juice. And so, therefore, it's taxed. It has less sugar than a can of juice. It's not. I have an example here. You guys can see it. I can give it to you too, Jim. Is that that's taxed? On the other,
but on the issue of meat taxes and bread and milk and groceries.
Yeah, there isn't a tax, but the reality of it is that there is the ability to do so.
Okay.
Right? And that's with a lot of different taxes. We talk about things not being on the agenda and on the deal. We didn't talk about carbon taxes 20 years ago or 15 years ago. I'm glad we're having the discussion.
Right.
But I mean,
so what about that, Jim? The idea is that maybe there are no taxes on these non-sweetened beverage. It's just a sweetened beverage tax in Seattle, but they're looking at the law and distributors, not sales taxes, but distributors could be taxed on groceries in Washington. So they're heading that off. Why isn't that their right?
Why would you pass a ballot measure for a non-existent problem? Nobody is talking about putting a tax on any other products except sugary drinks. Sugary drinks cause diabetes, obesity, and heart disease. Just like tobacco, there's a valid public health reason to tax these products and to raise revenues to meet important needs for our community. Why, if a local community in Washington State wanted to tax sugary drinks in the future, why should they not have that right to decide what's best for their community? Why should the state tell someone who lives in Spokane or Yakima how they should vote and how they should be able to run their local community business? I also wanted to point out the issue that the only drinks that are taxed in Seattle are ones with added sugars that are sugar-sweetened beverages. By definition, they have to have added sweeteners. So the juices, the things that are not 100% fruit drinks have added sugars in them, and if they cross the threshold, then they're valid for taxation.
Okay, well, our listeners can go find out exactly, you know, go online and find out what drinks are taxed. Pete, with the Yes on 1634 campaign, what about this? What about a state law that says local governments can only tax distributors on sugar-sweetened products and not other groceries? Wouldn't that be an answer?
So I think, quite frankly, we've seen the city of Seattle. It's a disaster in regards to what this tax. Like I said, it covers some sugar-sweetened beverages. It doesn't cover other sugar-sweetened beverages. It covers items that aren't sugar-sweetened. I mean, it is more appropriate to do this at the state level. And I think, just like tobacco, the citizens of the state of Washington, and I'm glad we voted yes on this in 2005, passed an initiative for to be non-smoking in public places. These, rather than having a hodgepodge of different laws, we should be handling this for a public health standpoint, for a worker standpoint, whatnot. We should be handling certain issues at the state level so we have consistency.
Okay.
But quite frankly, in regards to your question, I think it's something that should be. I think if the state wanted to take up that issue in regards to that piece, I think it's the most appropriate place to have that discussion so that we have consistency throughout the state of Washington. It's not just Seattle that has obese citizens. But
what about the local democracy ability of maybe Seattle wants a different law from Bellevue? What's wrong with the what you call a hodgepodge of different approaches by different cities?
Because I think so. One example in the city of Seattle, for instance, is that you have, let's say you have consumption that's driven down based on a law in the city of Seattle, right? What the problem with it when you don't have consistency is that you have border cities, White Center, Renton, Bellevue, not too far away. If you look at the data that the companies are pointing to, you are seeing increases in regards to what's being sold in these border cities.
But then how does that hurt the Teamsters if there's no overall decrease in consumption? People just go from one city to another. How does that costing jobs?
There's two things. So one, we've seen a correlation in regards to jobs lost. Two, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're covering everything that's being lost in the city of Seattle, right? So the city of Seattle is 700,000 citizens, right? Or give or take. White Center doesn't have that. Bellevue doesn't have that. So there still is a correlation in regards to lost business. But to be specific in regards to your question, if we want to deal with public health, just like we dealt with appropriately at the state level with the Citizens Initiative with tobacco, we believe that is more appropriate to handle these issues at the state level. Certain issues, right there with you in regards to local control. Other issues, I think it's more appropriate to handle at the state level. And the citizens made that choice in 2005. I was one of them that voted for that.
That's part of the argument for the Yes on Initiative 1634 campaign. This is a state initiative on your November ballot regarding the ability of local governments to tax groceries. First of all, Jim Krieger with the No Side, do you want to react to anything you just heard?
Sure. I think that, again, do we want to have Big Soda come in and spend $20 million telling local communities what they can and can't do? My answer to that is no. And that is why we need to be able to do this at the local level, because Big Soda and big industries can buy ballot election measures here. They can buy lobbyists and shape the outcomes in Olympia much more so than they can do at the local level. We want strong, local, vibrant democracies. This initiative sets a dangerous precedent to say that any big industry, whether it's Big Soda or another one, can come into Washington State, buy an election, and determine how our local communities, what they can and can't do. I'd also like to talk about the jobs issue. The one study that the proponents continually cite is one done in Philadelphia, which was paid for by the American Beverage Association, and which is fundamentally flawed from a methodological point, because it only looks at jobs within the beverage retail industry. It doesn't look at all the other jobs that are created by spending the tax revenues. It doesn't look at substitution effects when people buy other products like water. What we know in Berkeley is quite clear. Water consumption has gone up since the tax. The average grocery store trip but cost has not changed. Consumers are spending just as much, so sales are not going down in grocery stores. Again, just like the whole initiative campaign is based on the fear of something that's not happening. There is no grocery tax. The job loss argument is based on the fear of something that's not happening. There's no objective data and no credible data showing job loss. The University of Washington is actually going to be doing a study to look at the impacts on jobs, because we're concerned. If there were job loss, I wouldn't like that. But let's let the University of Washington do its study and find out here in Washington and here in Seattle if there are any job losses at all.
Meanwhile, Pete, what's wrong with the healthy food campaigns and other ways that the Seattle money, the sweetened beverage tax money, is being spent? Do you have any problem with any of that?
Have never had an issue with that and don't have an issue with that. I mean, Jim knows that. I mean, absolutely zero concerns in regards to that. The concern is when you're paying for these type of programs, the only issue that we have, when you pay for these items on the backs of working people, when you pay for these items on the backs of people of color, of communities of color, the people that can least afford to pay it. That's our problem with it. We have always wanted to partner with the opposition. We have talked about it during the Seattle campaign and all this stuff. We haven't done that yet. The opposition has not been interested in that. We're having some more conversations now, which I appreciate, but historically they haven't been open to that. We are absolutely open to having discussions in regards to tackling obesity and chronic health conditions.
What about a statewide tax on sweetened beverages?
We can talk about that, right? But I mean, that's not what we're talking about this time. I do believe, and the opposition has the absolute ability to do that. They also have the ability to partner with other folks and trying to put something in the state of Washington that impacts healthy outcomes, that provides, you know, I grew up in a food desert. I know what it means to not know what you're going to have for food the next day.
But is there an alternative that your funders would and supporters would propose that would be good for public health but not be regressive?
We haven't had a discussion on that, but what I can tell you is that the coalition members and with our organization, the Teamsters, we are absolutely open to talking about different methods to impact public health, to fight chronic health conditions, and fight obesity, as long as it's not on the backs of workers and the people that can least afford to pay it. We do not need another regressive tax in the state that has the most regressive tax structure in the country.
Jim, regarding taxes on sweetened beverages or candy, et cetera, if people want to put sugar in their bodies, why not let them?
They can, and the tax doesn't stop people from buying whatever they want. They're just going to be paying a little bit more for that.
So the tax is not to discourage consumption in any way?
No, I think as the price goes up, some people will choose to buy less, and that will be good for their health. But if they want to continue to purchase, this product will be there, and they'll be able to buy it.
But don't those choices fall hardest on someone who doesn't? If money's no issue, then I'll pay the tax and keep enjoying my sugar. But if I'm strapped and this is something I enjoy, why should the state get involved in my health?
I think what you'll see is because the revenues are going to be selectively invested in low-income communities and communities of color to fight exactly the problems that this unhealthy product, sugary drinks, causes: diabetes, obesity, heart disease. When you look at the net effect, money's going to be transferred from wealthier people to low-income people, because all the taxes that the higher-income people are paying in the soda tax, because the revenues are all going into low-income communities to fund these programs, there's a net transfer, actually, of resources from rich to lower-income communities. And so overall, actually, it's a very progressive policy because it deals with an important public health issue and it transfers resources from wealthy people to lower-income people on balance.
That's interesting, Jim. Are these taxes progressive or regressive?
The taxes, and the opposition is pushed this during the campaign and last year as well. But the reality of it is the tax is a regressive tax. There's not a study out there that doesn't state that these type of taxes, regressive taxes, don't hurt or impact the people that can least afford to pay them. Senior citizens, the people that are working families, people of color. The statistics are very clear on that, right? So I completely agree that there are items here that are progressive pieces, and we want to partner with the opposition. But you can't separate. You can't say that because it funds a progressive policy that it's no longer regressive. It is regressive. The tax is regressive. Nothing changes that fact. But what we can do is we can partner on looking at funding sources that are sustainable and that actually are progressive, so that it's a win-win for everybody. And that's what we want to focus on.
Jim, is it fair to talk about the Yes on 1634 campaign being all about the big funders, which are the soda companies? They have, Pete told us about the broad coalition, 1,400 different organizations, and he's with the Teamsters.
I think in politics, if you really want to know what's going on, you follow the money. And in this case, none of that broad coalition has contributed a cent to this campaign. The contributions are Coca-Cola now, $9.6 million. Pepsi, $7.3 million. Keurig Dr. Pepper Snapple, $3.19 million, and so on down the line. That's who's paying for this campaign. That's who brought this campaign to our state. It was the American Beverage Association, Pepsi, Coke, Dr. Pepper. That's whose lawyers wrote the ballot measure language. So this is not about something welling up from Washington State. This is outside big corporate interests paying to dictate local policy in Washington State.
Pete, how do you address that? Why is all the money coming from the big five?
There's a couple of things here. Number one, I would say that money in politics is something that I hope that we can agree on is a problem. It's no different today than it was last year. Money in politics is a problem, and I hope that we can get to a point where we don't have to deal with these type of campaigns or politics with that. But unfortunately, we're in a spot where it takes money to win campaigns. What I will say is, number one, the 1,400 coalition members may not have put in, and each one of them may not have put money in there. But I can tell you right now that from our members that are boots on the ground, that are knocking on doors, that are talking to their neighbors, this is a local campaign that stretches all across the state of Washington, from Forks to Spokane to Seattle to Walla Walla. And it is a grassroots here. Sometimes I will say this, is that you can't just look at the money. Because at the point, at the end of the day, the reason that we are part of this, we don't always agree with our coalition partners. We don't always agree with beverage. And I mean, clearly, there's history in regards to labor disputes or whatnot. But what I would ask people to look at is, why is this broad base of coalition members supporting this? They're supporting this because we agree that certain items should not be on the table. We agree that our state is far more regressive in its tax structure than it needs to be or has to be. And we believe that we need to focus on progressive taxation. Okay. That's why we believe that this is something that we support. If we didn't, if it was only about corporate interest or corporate profits, I can tell you right now, our organization would not support that.
And
it's
final,
not just that.
Thank you, Pete. We just have under a minute now. Jim Krieger. I gave Pete first word. You have last word. Why should people vote no on 1634?
I-1634 sets a dangerous precedent of letting outside corporate interests dictate local policy and what local communities can or can't do in the state. It's deceptive and misleading. It's proposing a solution to a problem that does not exist solely for the purpose of protecting the profits of Big Soda. And it's every community is unique. Washington voters are smart. That's why 51% are opposed to this measure at this point. Let each community decide for itself what's in its best interest and how it wants to do it, free of corporate interest, free of big lobbyists, free of Big Soda spending money.
Jim Krieger, Executive Director, Healthy Food America. Pete Lamb, Senior Business Agent with the Teamsters Local Union Number 174, debating Initiative 1634 on your fall ballot. Pete and Jim, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And finally, I want to turn to our reporter, Ruby DeLuna. Ruby, first, any reaction to what you heard?
Just a couple of thoughts. I do recall hearing from business owners who say that this soda tax in Seattle has affected business, and that this one business owner I talked to said he saw a 30% drop in sales ever since the city imposed this tax. And in regards to who is affected by this, it does affect folks disproportionately, communities of color. But if you look at the advisory board that's advising the council on where to direct the money for these programs, they are community groups who are affected by the soda tax. And there are discussions about, okay, how do we want to spend this money? So it's not the city council telling the communities what to do, but the communities having a say on this.
And in case you've just joined us, listeners, you've heard arguments back and forth, but remind us, just recap, Ruby, we're talking about 1634, which again would do what?
1634, if passed, it would basically prevent cities, counties, towns from imposing a tax on certain food items.
And finally, we have 30 seconds, Ruby. Do polls tell us anything about where voters are standing on the state initiative?
Sure. The recent poll that came out was from Crosscut Elway poll, and it showed that only 30% of voters supported this initiative.
Okay. We'll see. Fill out your ballot. We're here to help. Ruby, thanks for that.
Thank you so much, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW. Back in a moment. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. My next guest wrote a novel called Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. You may have heard of it. It got made into a movie, too. It was a satire about soldiers whose firefight in Iraq is caught on video. The soldiers are American heroes. They're set out on a victory tour, including the Dallas Cowboys Thanksgiving halftime show. That's Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. The book was enjoyed by someone at the British newspaper The Guardian. And The Guardian found the man who wrote it, Texas novelist Ben Fountain. And The Guardian asked Fountain, will you be our correspondent covering the 2016 American presidential election? So Ben Fountain hit the campaign trail and turned in a series of sparkling essays and turned the essays into a new book called Beautiful Country, Burn Again, Democracy, Rebellion, and Revolution. Ben Fountain told me that this country is heading toward its third existential crisis.
On the level of two previous existential crises in America, the first being the Civil War, which resulted in emancipation, and the second being the Great Depression, which resulted in the New Deal. And both were profound restructurings of American society. which
those are both such different events. How do you see the parallels between where we are now and either one of those?
Right. Well, in order for the United States to continue as an arguably genuine constitutional democracy, in both those cases, the social contract had to be reinvented. And obviously, with the Civil War and slavery, it was emancipation. It was extension of the proposition of equality to people of color. And obviously, in the practical effect was, you know, whatever freedom people of color got after 1865, it was problematic, continuous, and at times, practically non-existent. But we did get the 13th and 14th Amendments, and slavery was outlawed in the country. It was a profound reordering of the notion of American freedom. With the Great Depression, I think we've lost proper sense of just how desperate things were in the country by 1931-32, to the point that liberal democracy was competing with fascism and communism in the mainstream.
Not at the margins.
No, not at the margins at all. And in fact, publications like Barron's, which is the weekly Bible of Wall Street, and entities like the American Legion, they were floating the idea of we need somebody like Mussolini. Liberal democracy cannot deal with the problems of industrial capitalism. And
are you saying you're seeing an escalation of our tribalism, a violent escalation, or that you're seeing another worse version of the Great Recession? Or what leads you to put today's situation in those categories?
Right. Well, I mean, I propose an equation in the book: profits proportionate to freedom, plunder correlative to subjugation. And what I'm trying to do is get my head around the way freedom and economics have always worked in America. And basically, the more freedom you have vis-a-vis your fellow citizens, the more likely you're able to profit at their expense. And the extreme example of that is slavery. I mean, slave owners had practically unlimited freedom over the people they held in bondage. And as a consequence, they took practically all the profits of their slaves' labor. By the time of the Great Depression, industrial capitalism had basically implemented a new kind of bondage on the vast majority of Americans. It was a wage bondage. And there were tremendous concentrations, small concentrations, but tremendously powerful of wealthy people. And you could say they had tremendous freedom, whereas, you know, the people who are actually doing the work, were barely getting by. And that's not a society where you could say, you know, everyone is truly equal.
So you're saying income inequality is not just a matter of class envy or something, but that the more inequality is, the more the powerful people turn the screws.
Absolutely. You can't have political equality without a healthy measure of economic equality. And by that, I mean, it is really difficult for people to be free in their lives. And by that, I mean to have some meaningful degree of self-determination and agency in their lives if they are living on subsistence wages. They are basically at the mercy of, you know, their bosses.
Subsistence, absolute poverty, of course, is different from inequality, because couldn't you say in absolute terms there's more inequality, but absolutely there's more mobility, information, communication, leisure time, entertainment, life expectancy, that in absolute ways the average American's life is better than when you were born?
Well, the numbers show otherwise. Americans are working harder than they have since the 1930s, producing more but making less. I mean, wages have stagnated since the early 1980s. Life expectancy has dropped among white Americans, especially white Americans with, you know, high school education or less. Infant mortality is up. Maternal mortality is up considerably. In Texas, where I live, maternal mortality has doubled in the last 8 years. So, and Americans aren't as tall as they used to be. And that's an excellent indicator of quality of life and general social good in a society. So, you know, in the 50s and 60s, we were the tallest, but we've been surpassed by some of the Western European democracies, in the past 20 years.
The author is Ben Fountain, and the book is Beautiful Country, Burn Again. Ben, when Joan Didion said Beautiful Country, Burn Again, she was referring to wildfires, which can be good for a forest. Will today's politics be good for the United States in the long term?
Well, I think...
politics and economics.
Right, right. I'm not advocating for an existential crisis, but I think it will be thrust upon us unless some fundamental changes are made in the structure of society that will allow for, you know, people to live, you know, decent, dignified lives above subsistence level. But I think we're heading towards an existential crisis. It may well take the form of, what we went through in 2008, 2009, but a more severe version. It may well be a constitutional crisis that involves a president who has authoritarian tendencies and, you know, decides that he will, you know, exert his executive power to take more than his constitutionally allotted, power. I think the existential crisis could take various forms, but basically I think history shows that you cannot, for the long term, have a genuine democracy with the kind of economic inequality we have now, because it's not simply economic quality. It bleeds economic inequality. It bleeds over into the political realm. And even though, you know, working men and women in this country can vote, they can, you know, campaign for their candidates of choice. We have freedom of assembly, freedom of press. But there is a point at which concentrations of wealth and power become so great that they can influence elections and the electoral process to the point where that's where the power resides, you know, with the extremely wealthy. And I think we are quite a ways along that road already.
Well, you mentioned that we've been here before a couple of times. How was that inequality righted in the past? How is, as you said, the social contract reinvented? Mm-hmm. How did that happen twice before?
The first time the country literally burned. We fought a 4-year civil war in order for that had to happen for the United States to reinvent itself. The Great Depression, there were beginnings of, there was a low level kind of civil war breaking out in certain parts of the country. And that's another part of history we've lost. There were farmer strikes across the Midwest, farmers were marching on the state house in Nebraska. There were, when strikers were arrested in Council Bluffs, Iowa, 1,000 farmers, went and sprung them from the jail in Council Bluffs. And in some cases, judges and lawyers were beaten and in one case killed, trying to carry out foreclosure orders. So, it's very easy to look at the United States in 1932 and posit a drift towards civil war or a kind of Weimar drift toward totalitarianism, like what happened in Germany. So the early 1930s were just as dire, I think, as the late 1850s in the United States. But luckily, we had a really effective and far-seeing president, Franklin Roosevelt, take office in 1933, and he saw what needed to be done. And he articulated, as no president has ever done, the link between freedom, profits, and plunder. And he recognized that without economic freedom, without economic opportunity, the political rights of working men and women, they would be window dressing. It would be a kind of ersatz democracy, but not a genuine democracy.
How do we possibly predict the effects of jobs evaporating because of computers and artificial intelligence?
Right. I mean, that is a tremendous challenge. There's been a great deal written and spoken about job loss in the manufacturing sector. And there are job losses related to automation. And then there are job losses related to globalization and free trade agreements like NAFTA. And so I think, before we get to, joblessness because of, manufacturing going elsewhere or being, reinvented, we need to distinguish between those two things. I think that's a real challenge for society to, how is society going to provide meaningful work at, meaningful wages for working men and women when, increasingly computerization and robotization are doing a lot of the work that, humans used to do.
I can't quite imagine what the popular response, it's already happening, but it's going to accelerate. We keep hearing and the popular response, the political response, the economic fallout. I don't know what history tells us.
Yeah.
I don't know what anything tells us about how that's going to go down in this country.
I mean, we've never been faced with anything like that. I mean, the human race, where we're facing the prospect of millions and millions of people, without meaningful work because the work is being done by machines. And
some people say, great, that means we won't do rote, soul-killing work. What work and life is about.
If we're smart and innovative and wise, we'll figure out a way to hit the balance, to take full advantage of computerization and robotization. I could very well see society going opposite direction where the wealth that's created by this revolution in computers and robotization would be held by a very small segment of society, and the great masses of people will be left to fend for themselves. That's a recipe for, chaos and profound social disruption.
Yeah, well, that fits into your theories about freedom and profit and plunder and subjugation.
Yeah.
This is Ben Fountain. The book is A Beautiful Country, Burn Again. And I know it doesn't sound like it right now to our listeners, Ben, but you're a very funny and exuberant writer, and you find the United States funny in some ways.
Well, yeah. I mean, we're talking about pretty heavy things, and but politics is absurd and weird, and sometimes the only thing you can do is laugh your ass off. And I had a good time covering the campaigns.
You got assigned by The Guardian based on this novel that you wrote.
Right. Yeah, I wrote Billy Lynn. It came out in 2012, and where I really tried to dig into United States as it is today, this kind of exaggerated cartoon, media fantasy world of militarism and pop music and American triumphalism and softcore porn and but underneath that, is a very different reality. And I think that appealed to the editors of The Guardian, and they said, why don't you apply the Billy Lynn treatment to the election that's coming up in 2016, because it looks like it's going to be a pretty wild ride.
I appreciated how you didn't hide your, I don't know what the word is, it's not affection, fascination, for Donald Trump.
Well, it certainly wasn't affection.
Yeah, but you got at you could understand the pull of this man.
Absolutely. I mean, Trump is a phenomenal political talent.
Appreciation, that's the word
I wanted,
not affection.
Yeah, appreciation. I mean, the connection he would forge with his audiences was really extraordinary. And there is an animal force in him was when he's up on a podium in front of an audience that's predisposed, you know, to like him. And I mean, those were really extraordinary experiences, seeing him, you know, just how quickly and how intimately he could bond himself with his audiences. I mean, the man's got talent, political talent. There's no denying that.
And this is separate from your opinion about the Trump fascism talk. You cannot have watched Mussolini work a crowd and not think of that crowd effect.
Absolutely. Well, you know, if you look at his expression on the cover of his campaign autobiography, Crippled America, that came out toward the end of 2015, and he's got the classic Mussolini, you know, jawed scowl.
Yep.
And, I mean, it's almost a caricature of, you know, a stern, you know, uncompromising, determined leader. You know, what you know, this is obviously a man of action who's going to get things done, and which was exactly what Mussolini, you know, wanted to project. And a critical mass of the American public bought it.
The final scene in your book, Beautiful Country, Burn Again, you could have ended on so many things: tribalism, corporate greed, partisanship, artificial intelligence. We talked about money and politics. You ended on race.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I think race and racism are at the core of the American experience, at the core of the American psyche. I think America is a mentally ill country, and I trace the mental illness back to Jamestown, which was founded in 1607, and the first consignment of human beings held in bondage, African people, arrived in Jamestown in 1619. Obviously, the Jamestown, you know, settlers, as well as you know, all the people from Western Europe who came afterwards, held themselves out to be Christians. But the fundamental disconnect, the fundamental split in the psychology is, how can you be Christian when you're holding other human beings in bondage, in a very severe form of bondage? And not only that, you're undertaking a genocide of the people who were here before you, Native Americans. And I think that is the basic split in the American psyche. And until we come to terms with our history and the tremendous bloodshed shed and suffering that are a part of our history, we are always going to be struggling against ourselves and in ourselves.
Would you say that about any country that enslaved people on a huge scale, or is it uniquely American?
I think any country that practiced slavery on an industrial scale. And I mean, obviously there's been slavery all through human history, but with the colonization of the New World, we saw something that had never happened before, and that is slavery on an industrial scale in the service of capitalism, creation of wealth that would be held by a privileged class at the expense of a subjected class. And, I mean, 12.5 million people from Africa were taken on ships to go to the New World. 10.5 million arrived. And, I mean, that was something that's never happened in human history.
Finally, Ben Fountain, what gives you hope?
The sheer variousness of America. This is, I mean, the diversity of the country, the cultural diversity, the diversity of experience, the depth of experience, and, you know, the beautiful parts of our history. I mean, the founding fathers really did create something new under the sun here, a government dedicated to the proposition of equality. And at various points in our history, against, you know, counter-reactive, against reactive forces, we've made great strides toward making that equality principle the lived experience of the country. And I think we're coming to one of those crisis points where either we'll you know, take a major step toward realizing the equality principle, or the reaction will win and will become a country of, you know, plutocrats on top and the great masses of people struggling to survive beneath them.
Ben Fountain has written the book Beautiful Country, Burn Again, Democracy, Rebellion, and Revolution. Ben, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You're tuned to The Record on KUOW Seattle. It's 12:57. In the news this hour, a migrant caravan continues northward through Mexico, and President Trump is warning he will end or reduce aid to three Central American countries that he says were unable to stop the migrants from leaving. Trump called it a national emergency. Meanwhile, immigrant rights activists traveling with the caravan deny Trump's claims that terrorists are traveling with them. The activists say the people moving northward are driven by poverty, war, and hunger. You'll hear more about that, of course, this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. I hope you can join us. Also today on All Things Considered, should colleges give students Narcan, naloxone, so they can reverse opioid overdoses? Would that just encourage student drug use? Also, a new law might stop airlines from shrinking seats and taking away legroom, or it might not stop airlines from doing that. We'll show you how the law works. And more than 3,000 people in Sweden have gotten microchips implanted in their bodies. The chips work like key tags for the gym, for the parking garage, for the ticket booth. Just some of the stories you'll hear coming up this afternoon on All Things Considered on KUOW Seattle.